Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of July 3rd, 2015. When you hear the word anniversary, what kind of gut feelings do you get? Maybe it's the, oh, lovely, we get to celebrate feeling. Or the, oh, God, I forgot to buy something feeling. Or even another year and I didn't lose the weight, learn French, or whatever goal it is you set for yourself. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week on the show, yeah, anniversaries. Big settlements 5 years after the BP oil spill. How companies tap into our complex personal relationship with time. The 40th anniversary of a summer movie tradition. And, well, an anniversary for us. Marketplace Weekend is 1 year old, and we're celebrating, looking back and looking ahead. Come give us your thoughts on the first year of the show. Go to MarketplaceWeekend.org and click on Go. Visit the Marketplace Facebook page or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're starting the show with a fifth anniversary of the BP oil spill. 5 years ago, the 87-day spill sent at least 3 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico after the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon that killed 11 men. This week, BP agreed to pay $18.7 billion to settle litigation with Gulf states and the federal government. That includes the largest Clean Water Act fine in history. Apart from environmental damage, jobs along the Gulf Coast were lost and businesses shuttered. I remember standing on beaches with no tourists in sight. In the middle of all of this, a hotel opened on Florida's Pensacola Beach. The Margaritaville Beach Hotel, part of Jimmy Buffett's franchise and the first of its kind. Expectations had been high. The hotel had prime real estate on one of the most beautiful beaches in the Gulf. But even in peak season, it didn't sell out until Labor Day weekend, months after the opening. So 5 years later, what are the lingering economic effects of the spill? For a business perspective, we spoke to Jennifer Jackson, the director of marketing and hotel activities at the Margaritaville Beach Hotel. She spoke to us from the hotel, which is kicking off its summer season.
I mean, it's always stressful when you're going to open a new business, particularly, you know, open a new hotel with, especially with high expectations, since we were the first hotel that Jimmy Buffett, of course, Margaritaville, had ever opened before. So this is all eyes were kind of on us as far as being successful business on Pensacola Beach. So, and there are a lot of people relying on it. There were a lot of jobs at stake. So, you know, obviously when the oil spill happened, there was a lot of tension. There was a lot of nervousness on, you know, how is this going to affect our opening? How is this going to affect just people, tourism in general, people coming to visit us. And honestly, I think the positive parts were that we had such a good team, not only that was working to clean up the oil spill, but just at the hotel here, just to kind of keep everyone's spirits up, you know, through social media, through online marketing, just letting everybody know, hey, we are open, we are coming in business. Yes, obviously there's been a tragedy with the oil spill, but we're still open, we're still a beautiful beach, and, you know, we're still a great tourism destination. It was a little stressful, though.
I remember being there 5 years ago and, you know, on Pensacola Beach, places that were usually crowded were not. That must have been scary.
It was a tragedy. It was a tragedy for the people that lost their lives. It was a tragedy for the ecosystem. And there was a lot of trickle-down effect. Tourism is, of course, huge in Pensacola Beach area, for Florida in general. And so, you know, once we have something like that happen, of course, it's going to really halt a lot of the industries. And so, of course, there was a lot of businesses suffered. A lot of businesses went out of business. We were kind of one of the lucky ones that, you know, we're able to survive it and you know, still grow as a business. But those first couple months were definitely a lot of question marks out there.
What surprised you the most about the way the spill impacted your business?
We were able to see how the community came together. And as far as the industry goes, tourism has rebounded. It stalled there for a little bit, but right now it's kind of at its all-time high.
Yeah, I mean, we're 5 years out now. Do you feel like things have smoothed out, or can you still see places where the spill has left a lasting impact either on your business or on Pensacola?
Some businesses were hit harder than others. I know the fishing industry was one of the ones that did have a really negative impact. There's, you know, a lot of people, a lot of charter businesses out here that really depend on tourism through the major months, through our peak season, in order to survive. That's their business. And so I think they were really hit hardest from the hotel's perspectives. Yes, everyone, of course, took a hit when the oil spill happened. But in the last couple of years, we've seen nothing but progress. And so this year, we've had a record year this year. So we really see that it's coming back. And, you know, there was a lot of question marks. Well, you know, what are we going to see next year? What are we going to see 2 years from now? Or, you know, is there going to be dead fish washing up on shore? You know, or are there extra patches out there that had sunk and now are going to wash on shore? There's just a lot of questions we didn't know the answers to. But like I said, the last couple of years, tourism's really bounced back. We've had beautiful beaches. And we fortunately haven't seen a lot of negative impact going forward after that initial, you know, 2010 disaster.
Jennifer Jackson is the Director of Marketing and Activities at Margaritaville Beach Hotel in Pensacola, Florida. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You just heard the story of one business in the Gulf. Now to the larger picture. It may seem hard to believe, but 5 years after the spill, roughly half the people who filed monetary claims against BP and been approved still haven't been paid. Indeed, the final deadline to file a claim was only June 8th. Claims are paid from a separate pot of money from the settlement just agreed on this week. After a couple of different agreements and several trips to court, BP and the plaintiffs, mostly individuals and businesses, agreed on an uncapped settlement. The company would pay out claims of legitimate economic damage to people whose livelihoods were hurt by the spill. Frank Petosa is a partner at the law firm Morgan & Morgan, and he represents many of those people. I asked him to explain how this pot of money works.
Well, what it is it's an uncapped settlement fund that BP agreed to. And BP agreed to this in open court before Judge Barbier and in pleadings, and they agreed to a settlement fund that would have objective formulas put in place that would allow individuals and businesses to submit a claim and understand how they can qualify for compensation for a loss related to the oil spill, both based upon what their base compensation would be, how they would be compensated for future losses, and if, in fact, objectively, that loss was caused by the spill. This was all agreed to, not just by the attorneys on behalf of the claimants, but also by BP.
Can you give me a simple explanation of how a client or a theoretical client who files a claim figures out whether or not they get money? I mean, it's been 5 years.
It has been, but you have to understand that it's been in less than 5 years from the time that the settlement fund was created after Judge Barbier approved the settlement agreement and then had to withstand the attacks by BP that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and those attacks were rejected at the end of 2014. But the settlement agreement has very objective formulas to determine whether or not someone qualifies for compensation, meaning that their loss was caused by the oil spill. And that was one of the big issues that BP attempted to fight. Yet BP, at the same time, when the agreement was signed off on by both parties, they agreed to an objective formula, meaning that you didn't have to come in and prove by evidence that your loss was caused by the oil spill, that it was based on your financials. And if your financials met the objective tests and formulas, your business or you as an individual would qualify for compensation pursuant to the terms of the settlement agreement. If you have a business that's in the impacted areas, which would include the state of Louisiana, the state of Mississippi, the state of Alabama, the panhandle of Florida, the west coastal counties of Florida and Monroe County, if your business in any of those areas, depending on the type of category you're in, for example, if you're a tourism business, your loss is presumed to be caused by the spill in the areas closest to the coast. And what that means is if the objective formulas in the settlement agreement indicate that you have a loss in 2010 as compared to years prior, you're entitled to compensation.
I remember having conversations in 2010 and 2011 with people who said, well, wait a minute. Let's say you ran a topless bar in an area of Louisiana where you might usually have fishermen or oil workers there. And because of the spill, you didn't have the kind of customers that you would normally have. And they would say, that seems like a ludicrous thing for BP to compensate. What do you think?
It's not, because BP requested the settlement zones. Initially, the discussions were centered upon the businesses closest to the coast. BP wanted releases from as many individuals and businesses and entities they could get. So they wanted the whole state of Louisiana, the whole state of Mississippi, the whole state of Alabama, the Panhandle, the west coast of Florida, down to the Keys. BP negotiated and ultimately agreed to the formulas that are used in the settlement agreement to determine compensation and also determine if that loss was caused by the spill.
We know there are still questions about the environmental impact of the spill, the amount of oil that was put into the water, what happened to it. When you look at the financial impact of the spill 5 years on and look at that landscape, how would you assess it?
It really depends on the individual or business or governmental entity as to the degree of the impact. You know, some industries have been devastated. The oyster industry, especially in Louisiana, has been significantly impacted. There were businesses along the coast. I have clients that never recovered. They went out of business. You know, luckily, the settlement agreement put in place the ability for businesses that ultimately went out of business to receive some degree of compensation. So there's been a recovery, but the problem is we still don't know what the long-term impact is going to be on the environment. We don't know the long-term impact that it's going to have on some of the fisheries. It does appear that some of the areas along the coast from a tourism standpoint have rebounded. And as long as there are not any further problems with oil, it seems like we are moving towards a recovery. But the long-term effects are still unknown on the environment. And then the impact that may have on industries, especially, you know, the fisheries, are still unknown.
Frank Potosa is a partner at Morgan & Morgan, a law firm representing businesses and individuals with claims against BP. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. It's our show's one-year anniversary, and a lot has happened over the last year in the places where you and I interact with the world of tech. Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life for the past year. Welcome, Ben.
Yeah, it's been a year.
And what we're doing today is looking at developments in tech in the past year and a little bit into the future. What do you have for me?
All right. First, I want to talk to you about virtual reality. Now, I brought this little gift for you, Lizzie. I know it looks kind of cheap, and
like
it was pretty cheap.
A cardboard box with eye holes, which
yeah,
it is.
A cardboard box with eye holes and a hole for your nose. And it's this thing called Google Cardboard, which came out just about a year ago and is a very inexpensive introduction, if you will, to the idea of virtual reality that you can get from your phone.
How much does something like that cost?
$15 or less. So I take my phone and I'll put it inside here for you, and then you can take a look at it.
Why is it singing at me?
It's making little music.
Oh!
And if you look, move your head all over the place. If you look up, all the way up,
Whoa. And
look all the way around.
Oh, I can see this, like, adorable little cartoon forest landscape.
This is a 360-degree virtual reality environment, Lizzie. That's part of the Google Cardboard software.
Oh, leaves are falling. Birds are tweeting.
It's pretty cool, right? Essentially, it's like a little program, but it's kind of cool. So this launched about a year ago, and virtual reality is one of the things that in the past year we have really seen take off. And this thing launched a year ago, right? It looks really silly. It's essentially a toy. You can play with it as like a 10-year-old. But even since then, we've seen virtual reality move further into the mainstream. You've now got 4 or 5 companies that are putting out actual, much more expensive, much more fancy versions of this and the software that goes with it within the next year. And this could have implications for everything from how you do your shopping.
To, yeah, what do you do on them?
Really, I think a lot of people are thinking about this as a new way to share environments with other people who are far away. It's a new way to perhaps do shopping. You could go to a virtual mall and actually look at products and pick out products and have Amazon buy those products for you.
Virtual reality, obviously, sort of one big area where there's been a lot of development. The other one that kind of admittedly freaks me out is the self-driving car situation.
Yes. We've also seen a lot of movement in this space. We've seen...
No pun intended.
Yes. There's a lot of conversation happening around self-driving vehicles. You're seeing Apple, Google, Uber. This week, actually, Uber even invested a lot of money in mapping, which is really important for self-driving cars. Other big automakers like Honda and Nissan are looking into this. Ford just earlier this year opened a new, brand new office in Silicon Valley. So there's starting to be this crossover between the auto industry and the tech industry. In real life, self-driving cars for people like you and me is still kind of far off. What's closer and what we've also seen this year is semi-autonomous vehicle features. So you saw Tesla actually put out a car this past year that will change lanes for you and actually park itself for you.
The last time I was in Silicon Valley, there were people driving Teslas, and they were incredibly expensive. Is any of this stuff going to be in the purchasable realm for normal people? And if so, when?
I think that it's still really far off. There's still a very strong, bright line of divide there between the haves and the people who maybe don't have as much money to spend on this kind of thing. I think, though, over time, this technology will get cheaper and it will get introduced to not the luxury models, but the regular off-the-floor models. And we'll start to see that stuff happen.
In the realm of things that people can afford, tracking your fitness.
Yes.
You got a producer over there counting his steps every day.
Oh, yes.
Senior producer. So what's going on there?
Well, Lizzie, you and I have done a little bit of fitness tracking ourselves.
Yes, we did. I beat you in a push-up contest.
You did. You know, we've seen this stuff become much more common for people to wear. We've seen it become much cheaper. You can get a really good fitness tracker now for under $100 quite easily. Fitbit just had its IPO. I think in the last year, we've seen tech companies make the argument that fitness tracking and wearables can be affordable and useful in the hardware form. What we should look for in the next year for our 2-year anniversary conversation, Lizzie,
okay,
is whether or not users will really actually buy in and continue to buy in with this stuff.
So we can bring Dan in here and ask if he's actually still counting his steps.
We'll see if he still has a watch then.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Now to his 6th anniversary. That of Michael Jackson's death. At the end of his life in 2009, Michael Jackson was asset rich but cash poor with nearly $500 million in debt. Today, his estate has grown by nearly $1 billion since then, which is pretty much unheard of. To understand how this happened, we've got Zach O'Malley Greenberg. He's a senior editor for Forbes and the author of Michael Jackson, Inc. Zach, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The heck did all of this happen? That is a lot of money to generate 6 years after your death.
It sure is, yeah. You know, and that's kind of why I became so interested in it. You know, here you had this guy, Michael Jackson, arguably the most famous person in the world. At the time of his death, people largely thought that he was, you know, penniless. Not true, but he was not as well off financially as he could have been.
He had a lot of debt, yeah?
Yeah, he sure had a lot of debt.
How much are we talking about?
It was close to $500 million in debt. However, he also had probably well over $500 million in equity, just not very much in cash. And suddenly he dies. And now, you know, 6 years after his death, he's pulled in close to $1 billion posthumously, which is almost as much as he made in his entire life. $1.1 billion in earnings in his entire life, $1.7 billion adjusted for inflation.
On a really granular level, what makes money? Posthumous album releases, you know, appearing as a hologram at the Billboard Music Awards. Where does the cash come from?
The posthumous album, certainly. You know, there's a huge deal that the estate did with Sony for a record deal after he died to keep putting out the unreleased material. There was the This Is It movie, another huge, huge payday for the estate. Another big thing that maybe people didn't think was possible for anybody is this kind of ongoing life on the road. Michael Jackson has been touring for 6 years. Who knew?
Wait, how does that work?
Yeah, there is a Cirque du Soleil show called the Immortal World Tour that's been going around the world in arenas. It's now in the top 10 grossing tours of all time.
And does the licensing money from that generate back to the estate?
It's a joint venture with the estate, yeah.
Wow.
So it's not just licensing. It's totally a partnership. And everything, all the profits are shared.
When you look at this as an author, how much of this do you think is the phenomenon of someone dying young and some of the darker parts of his story sort of being erased from the collective consciousness? And how much of this is the lawyers managing his estate figured out some really smart ways to make money?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think you hit it right on the head. And, you know, Michael Jackson is this kind of ultra-American story. It's not rags to riches. It's sort of rags to riches to rags to riches, you know, if you want to put it that way. I mean, that might be exaggerating it a little bit. But, you know, here's a kid who grows up in the poorest of the poor places in, you know, in Gary, Indiana, and rises to become the most famous person in the world. You know, I like to say the most famous person since Jesus. I mean, pretty much, you know,
I mean,
you want to look at, I mean, that might, again, maybe exaggerating, but it's showbiz, right? He was a star, I think, in a kind of monolithic way that we don't really have anymore. You know, there's a lot of people who compete for our popular attention now, right? In music, maybe Katy Perry or Taylor Swift or Jay-Z or Beyonce. But if you had to say who is the number one, whatever, you know, or in movies or in sports, there's not anybody like that right now, I think.
Is it possible that there will ever be anybody like that again? You've also written about Jay-Z. Is there anyone else who could do this from now on, generate as much money, captivate as many people posthumously?
I think it's highly unlikely, and I think one of the reasons is that because we have so many new ways of accessing content, whatever you want to call it, there's more room for people to kind of self-segregate into different genres or different subsets of whatever it is that they're interested in. And, you know, back in the 80s, it was more of a monoculture. And sure, there were, you know, there were bits and pieces and you know, and groups and things that bubbled up from time to time. But Michael Jackson was able to incorporate a lot of that into his music. And, you know, he had hip-hop elements in his music before hip-hop was really a national or international thing.
How much of an aberration is Michael Jackson, do you think? I mean, you guys at Forbes make this list of profitable celebrities after their deaths. Elvis has been on there for a long time. How different is he?
Totally different. And, you know, the earnings certainly tell the story. Elvis Presley makes $40, $50 million a year still after his death, which is very good. It's very good for somebody who's alive.
Yeah.
But Michael Jackson has been in the hundreds of millions of dollars every year since he died. And in fact, in the first 5 years after his death, he earned more money than any single living musician over that period of time.
Why?
First of all, everybody already knew who he was, so there's an advantage there. There's this kind of popular obsession with a fall from grace, but also a kind of return to glory, you know? And you had both of those wrapped up in one kind of thing. And I think when Michael Jackson died, people, you know, ceased to conceptualize him as this kind of boogeyman living around somewhere. And, you know, whatever you want to think about the tabloids, you know, that was out there. And instead, they were suddenly thrust into this position of thinking of him in the Thriller era, because suddenly the Thriller video was back in heavy rotation, or maybe not in MTV because MTV doesn't really play videos anymore, but it was on YouTube and people are passing it around, and a whole new generation of kids was seeing, you know, this entertainer who maybe they'd never really seen before, maybe only really knew his name kind of distantly. And, you know, it kind of allowed him to be regenerated as mid-80s Michael Jackson.
Zach O'Malley-Greenberg, thank you so much for your time.
You bet.
For this next segment, I want to take you back to the summer of 1993 in Vermont. There was a terrible heat wave on the East Coast, and I remember that the only place my mother and I could find air conditioning was at the movies. So we went to see Jurassic Park, where, it turns out, the air conditioning actually broke. But that movie and Jurassic World, which broke box office records for its opening, owe their movie DNA to something celebrating its 40th anniversary this summer. Jaws. The first summer blockbuster. And to understand what makes a blockbuster and what makes it profitable, I spoke to Ira Kalb, professor of marketing at USC's Marshall School of Business.
The definitions are kind of changing now, but it started out to be a movie that grossed over $100 million.
Boy, that seems like small potatoes.
Well, it seems to be now because the costs average about that. And some blockbusters cost more. They go up to about $200 million.
Let's rewind a little bit and go back to the summer of 1975 when Jaws came out, sort of universally acknowledged to be the first summer blockbuster. What was so original either about the film or how it was marketed to the public that made it different?
Well, I don't know if this made it different, but the fact that Steven Spielberg was involved helped to market the movie. And what was different, it scared everybody. So a lot of people didn't go in the water. People were afraid to go to the beach and go in the water.
And if you were to, say, compare the marketing of a movie like Jaws to something like Jurassic World, I feel like we're talking about a totally different ballgame. What goes into marketing a blockbuster now?
Well, I think marketing anything is based on your target audience and giving them what they want. And the really good movies, the ones that are considered really fine movies or works of art, they don't typically do that well at the box office. And these blockbusters do because it appeals to a much wider audience. And the fact that most of the blockbuster sales are in the summer, it's because the kids are off school. And that's why they all try to get it within the summer window, because about 46% of the movie's revenue will come in the 4 months of the summer, May through August.
What makes a blockbuster succeed? Is it content or how you sell it?
I think it could be either or. And of course, the best combination is both. But I think the content has to be good. And if the content is really good, the movie will sell via word of mouth. And now with social media, word of mouth gets accelerated. And most of the moviegoers, 57%, I believe, of the movie revenue is from people that are 24 years of age or younger. And because of that younger audience, you know, you really have to tap into what they're looking for and understand what that, what I call the lock or the target audience is looking for. And I think that these blockbusters do that. They've kind of found a formula. In fact, a lot of the studios are going to the comic book characters because they're already known and they already have a brand identity.
Well, sure. And you have a built-in audience, right?
Exactly. And they're also doing, that's why they do a lot of these sequels. And of course, if the sequel doesn't live up to the original, it's going to get negative word of mouth. On social media, people say don't bother. But if they do, or if they're even better, then that will really accelerate the sales of the movie. So it's both the content and the marketing.
Who's done it well?
Well, I think that just by looking at the results, Jurassic World has done it well. And I think a lot of the companies that are have a good social media presence. I know Disney and Pixar invest a lot in social media. They're really big on that, and they seem to be doing quite well on that as well.
When we look at what's out there, so much of this is franchise heavy. Jurassic Park movies, the Fast and Furious movies. Is there room out there for successful original content, or are blockbusters these days things that already have an identity?
The fact that things have an identity lowers the risk in making the blockbuster movie. Of course, there's room for original content, and if the original content is really good, it will create a new franchise. And they're always looking for those things. Pixar is very good at that. They create a new original content film, and then they'll create sequels to that film. And they've been very successful, even with their sequels. The reason that people go back to comic book characters and go back to, let's say, previous movies, and this is the next one in the sequel, is because in their mind, it lowers the risk. There's already a brand identity established, and it already has a following. And people are curious to see what the next one's going to be like.
Ira Kalb is a clinical marketing professor at USC's Marshall School of Business. Thanks so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're talking about anniversaries this week, but before we get back to that, we're going to look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
26 million.
At least that many Facebook users rainbow-fied their profile photos.
Something you may have seen a lot of after the Supreme Court's ruling legalizing same-sex marriage.
66,320.
That's how many people used Airbnb to stay in Paris's Marais neighborhood last summer.
Fun fact, that's more Airbnbers than people who actually live there.
115.
That's about how many countries Apple Music and the Beats One radio station are available in.
The streaming service launched Tuesday to solid reviews.
Apple is kind of late to the streaming music party, so it'll be interesting to see how they compete.
And finally,
1 year
is how long this show has been on the air.
Happy anniversary, Marketplace Weekend.
The numbers that dominate our show today are anniversaries of all kinds. So we asked people on the streets of downtown Los Angeles about the last anniversaries they celebrated.
Last anniversary we celebrated. Ooh. Well, I guess it was our fourth year anniversary. Wedding anniversary.
100 days. 100 days with my girlfriend.
With your girlfriend, you did a 100-day anniversary.
I give a gift for her, and we kissed.
My wedding anniversary. We went out to dinner.
Same thing, wedding anniversary.
Father's death on Father's Day.
The last anniversary I celebrated was my friend's death, and it was Manuel. He passed away on, it's been 3 years already, you know? We go to his grave, and, you know, we bring him food. Like, I remember we brought him a plate of food, like, that's what we brought them, man. We just brought beers and stuff. But what really, like, meant something was a plate of food, like homemade food, you know? And we just brought it to him. And that's what you do for the Día de los Muertos as well, but just do that too as well.
Anniversary. For what?
Fourth anniversary, we went and just spent the day in Chicago. That was it. It was really nice. You know, just meet him. And the kids was with his mom, so it was really great. It was really inexpensive, and that's all I'm asking for. He don't have to be the richest man in the world.
After hearing all those voices, think about what you buy for an anniversary and who's influencing that, maybe making a little money off our emotions. We turn to Cassie Mogilner, an associate professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
When we think about anniversaries, and you heard all those different kinds, how do companies sell them to us, and why?
Yeah. So one thing you'll note, all of those folks that you asked about a recent anniversary, all of them were in the context of a relationship with another person. And so that it starts to get at why companies highlight anniversaries, because it is really serves to highlight the relationship that consumers have with the company.
I understand in your research, particularly the recipients focus on kind of the thought that went into this thing. It's not like, oh yeah, my partner went out and got me this really expensive gift. It's, oh, he or she thought about me and what I love.
Yeah, which again, I think is actually really neat, because gifts in general, thoughtfulness is important. But in particular, anniversary gifts, it's really about a gift that highlights the relationship and providing evidence that you know the person, that you've spent time together in the past. And we have some research where we have looked at the connecting power of gifts, finding that actually giving experiences serves to be more connecting than giving material goods. And so it was really neat hearing that one woman who was talking about her anniversary with her husband, where they, you know, took a trip to Chicago. And that, of course, was, it sounded like a little trip and a vacation and an experience that they shared together. Again, not only are they spending that time together for, like, during the celebration of the anniversary, but it's really drawing people to think about the time they've spent together in the past.
The flip side of this also brings out a conversation I had with someone in my office about anniversaries, and her reaction was, oh God, I hate those things. It always makes me feel guilty because I need to do X or Y. So the buying motivation seems complicated.
Yeah, definitely. So we give gifts out of both guilt as well as gratitude. So these are two separate emotions that both of them are very sort of effective in motivating us to give to relationship partners. The interesting thing is that gifts that are given out of guilt or gratitude, even holding the gift itself constant, has very different effects on the gift giver than the gift recipient. So when, so when a gift is given out of guilt, it makes the gift giver feel closer to the person. They feel like they've sort of accomplished something and they feel good. But if you ask gift recipients actually, or that they've received, that were given out of gratitude, that makes them feel more connected. So you see this asymmetric effect.
What is the fresh start effect?
Yeah, so the fresh start effect is an effect uncovered by some of my colleagues here at Wharton, including Katie Milkman. And what they found is that when there are these temporal landmarks, oftentimes you think of New Year's or the beginning of a week, having these temporal landmarks actually motivates people to pursue their goals much more sort of effectively than otherwise. And so that's why you see people going to the gym a bunch in January, because it sort of marks the passage of time. They don't feel quite so guilty about the past year, and they think that, oh, it's a fresh start, so they will start to behave differently in this new point in time. And so when you think about anniversaries, this is an interesting sort of phenomenon where it is, again, in the context of a relationship. And so you can think about it not only as an opportunity to reflect on past time, but also as an opportunity to engage with your relationship partner in a way that is desirable. It serves to re-engage folks with their relationship partner.
When I think about all the emotion that we heard in those people's voices and the research you're talking about, how much do companies know about this? I mean, do they just look at us and think, oh man, they are suckers and we're going to tee all this stuff up and sell it to them?
Well, I think it's less nefarious than that. I mean, I do think that I actually encourage my business school students to think of brand management as relationship management. And so by highlighting anniversaries, you're highlighting to consumers that there is a relationship, and having spent time in the past, it leads them to want to spend more time and perhaps more money in the future. So in some of my own research, I found, for instance, when you lead people to think about the time they've spent on a product versus the money they've spent on the product, they feel They like the product more when they think about the time spent, and they feel more connected to the product. Now, the interesting thing is the consequence of feeling more engaged and focusing on that relationship is that you will spend more time and money in the future. So by thinking about time, you'll actually get the benefits from the marketer's perspective or the company's perspective with respect to expenditures of time and money.
So to get a little personal, I understand that you're coming up on your 6th wedding anniversary. Is that right?
Yes.
So I guess the traditional thing, and this is so weird, but you would buy your partner candy? What? What did you find out about like research into gift giving, and are you going to do that?
Well, I would like it if he were to give me candy, me being a lover of chocolate. So creativity, for one thing, it helps to have a starting point. And oftentimes when we're coming up with gifts to give, this sort of big, like you could give anything is very daunting. And so if nothing else, having these silly rules of what to give is a sort of starting place to get your sort of thoughts moving on what types of gifts to give. That said, I actually had no idea what are the gifts that are given to demarcate each one of these anniversaries. And so while I will tell my husband that this is his opportunity to sort of lavish me with candy, I'm not particularly excited about a future anniversary of tin or wool, for instance. And so I might try to highlight the experiential versus material components of gift giving so that I get more sort of dinners out and concerts to go to.
Cassie Mogilner is an associate professor of marketing at the Wharton School. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
After consulting Professor Cassie Mogilner about the business of anniversaries, we started wondering, okay, what are all those special traditional things for your first year, second year, third year of relationship? If, you know, 6 years means candy. So we made this incomplete list of gifts for anniversary years. Starting at the very beginning, you buy a gift that sounds like this. First anniversary, paper. Second anniversary, cotton. Third anniversary, leather.
Leather.
Fruit. Wood.
Give me some candy now.
Candy. Wool. Pottery. Willow, tin, steel, silk, lace, animals, ruby, 45th anniversary, sapphire, 50th anniversary, gold, 60th anniversary, diamond.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. On this anniversary edition of the show, we're also looking back at some of the places we've been this first year and who we've heard from. Your stories about where the economy collides with real life, like Darlene Bell Grayson, who felt her personal economy collapse and found herself in this situation.
I'm homeless. I really am homeless. But I'm not the homeless person that you see and you think is homeless. I'm not on the street. I'm not dirty. I'm not raving and needing medication. I'm not the typical face of a homeless person, but I actually am. And I don't know where I'm going to go, and I don't know what I'm going to do. It just never crossed my mind that I would ever be in a place of being without, because I had saved so much. I always had it in my mind, I want to be able to make it through the lean times. So I learned from my parents budgeting very well. And so here I am. I have no unemployment. I have no job. I have no prospects. I have no rent.
We also examined how cities are adapting to be a little easier and more walkable for retirees. And we enlisted this guy, my dad, as our tester.
I know that my balance is not as good as it once was. I do some exercises to try and maintain my balance, and that's great, but that doesn't cover the situation where a problem comes up in a very impromptu, sudden way, and you have to deal with it. That's when you're in danger of falling.
We also took you to visit a meteorologist who lived through a tornado. He shared his outlook on money earlier this year.
We had a house full of antique furniture, just all kinds of valuables. This tornado was not like blowing a house over. This was like being hit by a bomb. Everything was in splintered pieces. And so there was really nothing salvageable. So everything from that point on in our lives was substantially downsized to what we felt like we only needed. Before, we had had all this stuff that, you know, was just stuff that was pretty to look at, but it wasn't a necessity of life. So it changes your perspective about things and the value of things.
And the band Future Islands told us what it feels like to make it big, and then taxes.
We were pretty far in the red at the end of last year because we'd pretty much sunk everything into the music, as well as getting hit with 2012 taxes in the middle of producing the album. And we were just like, oh, we forgot about that. We got hit really hard with taxes last year. Our accountant called us in one day, and he's basically like, well, first off, you know, you guys have very high taxes because you made a lot of money last year, a lot more than I expected. And because you're an LLC, you're in the highest tax bracket. And I was kind of looking at the guys like, should we high five? Is that, I was like, we made it in the highest tax bracket and we got destroyed. We got destroyed by the U.S. government. Maybe they'll come after us.
They beat us up and they handed us our wallets.
We visited a lab where color-changing squid ink inspired how the military is making new camouflage and what that might mean for the future.
In the next decade or so, maybe something along the lines of a color-changing shirt. I think I look even further, maybe, you know, even 30, 40 years down the line, where you could have a shirt that looks more like formal wear in one situation and then changes to look more like an informal T-shirt in another situation.
And we heard from you on what it feels like to come out at work and how something like a resume can tell a deeper story.
At the very top of my CV is my name, my full legal name, which is Joseph Simonis. And then underneath that, I typically go by Josie, and so that's listed. But then also two are my personal pronouns. So I use either she or they pronouns, and that's listed right at the top. I actually don't have a choice in terms of whether or not I'm out in the workplace or really anywhere in my life. I'm pretty visible in terms of being trans, and if I, you know, go to the bathroom or somebody refers to me in conversation, it's pretty obvious instantly to other people that I am trans and that I am queer.
And I went to Brazil, where, over dinner, we met a middle-class family caught in the midst of Brazil's high prices, corruption, and slowing economy.
Yes, it's already affecting us through the increase in the cost of living. Light is going up 26%. Water is scarce. There's going to be a rationing and also an increase. The government does not have the structure, and this is affecting us. And we pay the taxes, and we get no proper structure. That's why everything in Brazil is absurd.
It's been a good year, and we couldn't have done it without you. So please keep telling us your stories about money, life, and what the economy looks like from where you are. And that's our show for this week, wrapping up our first year. Next week on the show, legacies. So here's a question. What do you consider your financial legacy to be? Come tell us. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and click on Go. Or you can tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. Our show is produced by Eliza Mills and Jenny Ament. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. And Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.